want to be a force of change. We're going to continue to speak out.
Joe Miller gives up his legal challenge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, power is being restored to the St. Lawrence Island community of Savoonga.
You know, we're optimistic that they'll be done with that by the end of today.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
Joe Miller announced today that he will no longer pursue legal challenges against the election results that gave Lisa Murkowski an historic write-in win against him in the general election for U.S. Senate. Miller said he had no immediate plans for a political future, but he signaled that he will still be in the mix.
We want to be a force of change. We're going to continue to speak out. I've not reopened my law practice. Right now, I don't intend to do so. But frankly, our effort is not done. We still have lots to do, and it's not just me. It's a number of other political figures, such as myself, that really do desire to turn this nation around.
Miller last met with the Alaska Press in October when he announced he would no longer speak to them about his background or personal issues. Many Savoonga residents are spending New Year's Eve at the local school due to power outages that have plagued the St. Lawrence Island community since Monday. At one point, about 80 homes were without electricity, but Mira Kohler, CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, says linemen have restored about half of those.
As of last night, about 6 o'clock or so, we had managed to restore service to all but about 40 meters. And that condition held through the night, so we are feeling reasonably good that we're not going to have a recurrence there. But we still have about 40 locations that are out of power that the linemen are working on right now.
Three linemen are working on the power problems, which started when severe winds mixed with severe cold caused above-ground electric lines to slap against each other, causing the initial problem.
You know, after days of thinking, oh, we've got bad transformers or something like that, what we have realized as we've been trying to re-energize portions of town is we can see that there's arcing going on that's being caused by freezing salt spray on the lines and on the transformers and on the insulators. And when you have frozen salt spray, it basically allows electricity to track across the surface and causes essentially a fault to ground.
She says none of the lines are actually broken, but finding the exact source of the power fault is proving difficult.
And you turn on the electricity, those wires get energized, and where they are attached to the insulator, you're going to see a sparkling at the top of the pole because you've got arcing going on with the salt spray that's frozen. And so it'll be kind of pretty for a few seconds, but then the power is going to go out because the power plant sees that as a ground fault, and it goes, uh-oh, we got a problem here, and it kills that line. And so that's why we continue to have one of our three phases, which is the C phase. It is still down, and we don't know why or where exactly the fault lies.
She says the situation is unique in her experience with bush power issues. Many Savoonga residents were forced to seek shelter in the school after the power failure caused homes to freeze and pipes to burst. The school generator kept power and heat on at the facility. Yesterday, the Red Cross shipped emergency food and blankets and other supplies to Savoonga from Anchorage. The local clinic also has power. Kohler says Savoonga has had electricity for about 4 decades, but the fact that the community is built on rock does not make putting lines underground feasible. The The Alaska OWL Online with Libraries project celebrated its statewide launch this month. The ambitious undertaking is a three-year, $8.2 million effort to connect all 105 libraries in Alaska to high-speed video conferencing. From Barrow to Dutch Harbor to Ketchikan and throughout the interior, every library will receive assistance. Glenn Cook is the Deputy Director for the State Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums. Cook says many libraries in Alaska serve very small populations, but the services are critical. He says the money and the tech support will bring all libraries up to a minimum of 1.5 meg broadband.
So that they will be able to participate from anywhere in the state with educational programs or programs from departments that relate to health or a whole variety of things, to bring them up to a level where they can participate in those programs. They can do distant education and things that will help them improve their lifestyles.
Cook says all libraries will receive hardware upgrades.
It'll vary from a full video center in a separate room for them to ones that would have a video camera on a laptop or something. But depending on the size of the library and their capacity, everybody will have some form of video conferencing capability.
Cook says many libraries in Alaska operate on an all-volunteer or limited-hour schedule, and those that are open for less than 20 hours per week will be eligible for money that will pay for an additional 5 hours per week. He says the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, or AVTEC, will provide training and on-call technical support to library staff. Laura Breeden is with NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Breeden is the program director for the Public Computing and Sustainable Broadband Adoption Program at NTIA. She says the library usage is rising because of internet access for people who need help from a librarian or don't have online capabilities at home. She says they invested in Alaska communities because of the challenges of access in rural Alaska.
They came to us with a very innovative proposal around multiplexing satellite bandwidth, which was going to make the higher speed service more affordable, even for the libraries who are far away from any kind of ground-based communications line. So we really see this as a winning program in that it's going to reach into the farthest corners of Alaska in ways that are very innovative and cost-effective, and bring all that information that's only available on the internet into the villages and the homes of people who live there.
Breeden says the Alaska Project is one of 230 programs nationwide they supported as part of a $4.7 billion Recovery Act grant. She says extending connectivity helps with the overall expense in rural parts of the state.
More competition will ultimately drive down the cost of some of these services so that in the long run they become more affordable. And I think even in places like Alaska where the terrain is so difficult and the distances are so large, you're seeing more providers coming in and more people thinking about how to push the infrastructure out to the most remote areas of the state.
Funding is through the State Division of Libraries, the Universal Services Fund, and the Rasmussen Foundation. Jeff Clark is with the Rasmussen Foundation. He says the Family Foundation has always been big supporters of libraries in Alaska, and this project will help drive what he expects will be significant changes in the marketplace over the next 3 years.
We're going to see some new entrants here in Alaska. We're going to see advances in technology. And one of the most important goals, I think, that we all share, all of us who are working in the project, is to develop a sustainability model. And we'll be looking closely over the three-year duration of the project to kind of map what's happening on the competitive basis, what's happening on the technology front. And of course, we're going to be very interested in not only the impact, but most importantly, the feedback of communities around the state.
Links to more information is at our website, aprn.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrity journalist Bob Babel visits Alaska politicians.
Senator, what was it like being the lone senator for Alaska in the weeks following the recent election?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is our last program of the year at the Alaska Public Radio Network, and like other news organizations, before launching into a new year, we'd like to take a last look at the old one, with the idea that if we know where we've been, we may have some insight into where we are going. But after looking over the things we reported on in the state of Alaska in 2010, APRN's Steve Heimel says at this point we may know that our direction has changed, but that does not mean we necessarily know where we are headed.
If Alaska were a 51-year-old person instead of a state, it might be said that it was having a midlife crisis. We come out of the year 2010 a very different state from the one that went into it, but it may take a while to sort out what that means. Take the election, for instance. You would have thought incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski to be a shoo-in for re-election, but there were forces of discontent in the state, and come the August primary, she was defeated by Joe Miller, one of a raft of what became known as Tea Party candidates across the nation seeking to reform and shrink the federal government. But this is Alaska. It didn't end there. An unprecedented write-in campaign with a big financial boost from the native corporations did indeed succeed.
We did. We made history. Alaskans made history. And doesn't it just feel wow?
But what will become of the political forces that almost toppled Murkowski is very much an open question. Alaska's former governor, Sarah Palin, now a national celebrity, backed Miller and a number of other reform candidates. Her support in her home state may be eroded somewhat, but when she came back for a 9/11 public appearance with talk radio host Glenn Beck, long lines of people were willing to pay the price and stand in the cold during the security checks, looking at protesters, bearing signs.
What I'm hoping is that over time, those people who have them on such a pedestal will come out of denial.
Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin believe what they say. There are people who say Glenn Beck, conservative, and they add a lot of baggage to that, which isn't true.
In the year 2010, the lives of two of the most important figures in Alaska's first 50 years of statehood came to their ends. Twice Governor Wally Hickel, who, as he wished, was buried standing up so he could come out fighting. And then, in early August, word came that an airplane flying out of a fishing lodge in Bristol Bay had crashed into a mountain. Former Senator Ted Stevens was aboard that plane and did not survive, along with four others. The magnitude of this was such as to draw the chairwoman of the National Transportation Safety Board, Deborah Herzman, to the state to join the investigation.
They estimated that there was about a 100-yard gash leading up the hillside as the plane traveled up the hillside and then came to rest.
Poor visibility was the likely cause of the crash. Indeed, while any year will see fatal plane crashes in Alaska, there were a large number of them in 2010, and a state investigation pointed to weather as a frequent factor. But not in the case of a giant C-17 military cargo jet that crashed after taking off from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, killing all three aboard. Pilot error, the investigation said. Alaska saw an extremely unusual death from a wolf attack. A young teacher out running at Chignik Lake was apparently pulled down by wolves and killed. Later in the year, across the Alaska Peninsula at Port Moeller, a number of wolves were killed by the Fish and Game Department when they started nabbing household pets. An avalanche early in the year took the life of Jim Bowles, the president of ConocoPhillips Alaska, when he was out skiing. There were deaths as well of some military personnel returned to Alaska bases from combat, and the number of deaths among the homeless in Anchorage near double digits for the second year. In Hoonah, two police officers were ambushed and killed. John Marvin Jr. was arrested. Terrorism came to Alaska with the surprising arrest of a King Salmon weatherman and his wife for putting together a hit list of public figures for assassination. As the decade ends, prospects are mixed for Alaska's relationship with the federal government. Republican Governor Sean Parnell was easily elected to the office he succeeded to when Sarah Palin quit. He's looking at an Alaska without the largesse and protection of Ted Stevens, diminishing oil production, uncertain gas line prospects, and the likelihood of the lower 48 recession lingering over the 49th state, all the time Parnell saying he wants job creation.
And when I think about jobs, I think about economic growth, and I think about the federal government, for example, and whether they are diminishing our opportunities for economic growth.
By year's end, Parnell had lawsuits pending against the federal government on health care reform, fishery curtailments, and several endangered species actions. And a huge uncertainty about offshore oil and gas drilling in the Arctic Ocean after the catastrophic blowout of the Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. Not only did that spill exceed the Exxon Valdez, but it prompted changes in federal offshore oil and gas policy and has also caused the oil and gas industry to step back and take another look at itself and the risks it's taking. The high price of crude oil continues to provide the capital for exploration and development, but how much in Alaska and its waters is very much unknown as the year 2011 begins and Alaska continues to navigate into its next 50 years. I'm Steve Heimel.
I'm Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, where residents celebrated the town's centennial, voted to end smoking in bars and restaurants, and ended the year with city employees preparing to take a strike vote. The city's 100th birthday was marked with events throughout the year. The largest was a community panoramic photo, as close to half of the town's population turned out to pose for the camera April 20th up at the ball fields.
Hey, 20 people from this side on the far left. And move them over to fill in on the right side. That would do it, I think.
The city could not reach an agreement on a new contract for the bulk of its employees in 2010. An impasse at the bargaining table prompted city workers to express their frustration at several city council meetings.
These people haul your trash away, clean your water, dispose of your sewage, plow the snow off your streets, look after your boats. The police and the firemen respond to your calls for help. We take care of your elderly and bury your loved ones.
Workers by the end of the year were preparing to take a strike vote. A mainstay of Petersburg's visitor industry, Cruise West, stopped sailing and shut down its operations in September. In October, voters passed a smoking ban for bars, restaurants, and other public spaces. Some smokers expected a change in the local bar scene.
Your entire evening shift is going to be a lot younger crowd, the ones that grew up without smoking.
As the year drew to a close, the city continued its efforts to form a new Petersburg borough.
A debate over the location of a new public library, bonding propositions, and a political misstep were just some of the top stories in 2010 for the first city. After weighing in on two competing ballot initiatives and much community debate, voters in August passed a proposition allowing a new public library to be located anywhere within city limits. In October, Ketchikan voters also approved a $5.2 million bond proposition to pay for the construction of the new library. Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson was elected to a third term, handily defeating Democrat Otter Mobley in the race for House District 1. Johansson, however, gave up his position as House Majority Leader after walking out of an organizational meeting of the Republican-led House Majority Caucus in November. Johansson later held meetings in Ketchikan where constituents voiced their general disapproval of Johansson's actions, some asking for his resignation.
If I step out trying to do something about statewide issues that someday are going to affect Ketchikan, and I did that in error, then I am sorry, and I apologize to the voters of District 1.
In early October, a massive windstorm caused area-wide power outages. Winds of more than 100 miles per hour were reported in Ketchikan, and some homes remained without electricity for several days. The city saw completion of a new water treatment system using a combination of ultraviolet light and chloramine to disinfect the water. Though the switch to the new system was expected to take place this fall, testing is still ongoing and final permits are pending.
That report from Maria Dudzak at KRBD in Ketchikan.
I'm Rosemary Alexander in Juneau. As the year rolled in, the world recession appeared to be hitting the capital city. CBJ forecast an $8 million budget shortfall based on an expected decline in sales tax as fewer cruise ships were scheduled to visit. City Manager Rod Swope even asked CBJ employees to defer a pay raise. They refused, and in the end, assembly members balanced the budget with city savings and excess tobacco tax revenue. While sales tax collections did decline during the summer tourist season, local spending helped make up the difference. The U.S. Census got underway in April. CBJ had the highest participation rate among Alaska Census areas, with 75% of questionnaires returned.
We are being fleeced under the guise of genuine economics.
That seemed to be the feeling of a lot of Juneau residents when they heard in May that Alaska Electric Light and Power planned to phase in a 24% rate increase. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska granted 20% of it in July. Now the cost of a kilowatt hour is nearly 12 cents. The RCA has until July to rule on the full rate increase.
The hole was a problem, but the plywood fence, that just went over the edge.
Capital City residents breathed a collective sigh of relief when Sea Alaska Corporation and June bought the pit, the garbage-strewn vacant lot on the corner of Front and Seward Streets. Sea Alaska plans a Southeast Alaska Native Cultural and Visitor Center there. While it will be some time before that's realized, the hole has been filled in and landscaped. The crusher at the Kensington Gold Mine can break down 2,000 tons of rock a day. The opening of the mine tops Juneau's 2010 business news. Since July 23rd, it has produced more than 16,000 ounces of gold. With a workforce of nearly 200, Kensington is one of Juneau's largest private sector employers. In the October municipal election, one of the most controversial issues to come before Juneau voters proposed to tie up a 1% sales tax for 10 years to build a crossing between Juneau and Douglas through the Mendenhall Wetland State Game Refuge. It failed by a huge margin.
This is Ed Ronco in Sitka, where 2010 was a busy year for many things, including politics. Sitka saw some attention from the U.S. Senate candidacy of then-Mayor Scott McAdams, but locally, political attention focused more on a squeaker of an election for his mayoral replacement. After two recounts, Cheryl Westover won by two votes against John Stein. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska also made political headlines this year with the removal of Councilmember George Paul. The way Paul's removal was handled, mostly in executive session, along with the process used to appoint his replacement, has caused strife at meetings in the last couple months and has initiated a recall effort against the tribe's chairman. Some crime stories also topped the news in 2010. In January, state investigators cracked a 22-year-old Sitka murder case. Jane Reth pleaded guilty to killing her then-husband Scott Coville in 1988. In July, the community mourned the loss of three Coast Guardsmen from Air Station Sitka, Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks were killed in a helicopter crash off the coast of Washington. Lieutenant Lance Leone survived. The crew was remembered during a memorial service at Air Station Sitka a week later. Hundreds of community members attended the service, along with Alaska Governor Sean Parnell and Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp.
It's really a time for us to get together, to celebrate the lives of these great heroes, and then to shore each other up to be able to get through the tragedy.
Today, 6 months later, memorial postcards are still on display throughout town, and the assembly voted to name a ball field after Kruger, who was a well-known soccer coach in Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska tourism promoters hope to attract more visitors to the state through advertisements that will run with popular Alaska-themed television series. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
These are the men who make their living on thin ice.
That's the theme for Ice Road Truckers, one of a handful of cable television series set in Alaska, featuring storylines about life on the last frontier, or at least popularized versions of life up here. The shows have drawn sizable audiences nationwide, and Alaska tourism officials hope a new series of advertisements will convert those viewers into visitors. The Alaska Travel Industry Association has launched a $600,000 advertising campaign that will run commercials on those shows, including Sarah Palin's Alaska. That's the Learning Channel series that features the ex-governor and Fox News pundit giving her version of Alaska and Alaskans. The Travel Industry Association also has bought some spots on the Discovery Channel's Deadliest Catch, a reality show depicting the perilous lot of those who work in Alaska's commercial fishing industry. Ads also would be booked on Ice Road Truckers, a History Channel series that recounts the winter driving exploits of big rig drivers who run the Dalton Highway from Fairbanks to Prudhoe Bay and back. An association spokeswoman says the ads will run through mid-March. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And finally tonight, as we prepare to head into the eve of the new year, we'll first check in with intrepid spoof reporter Bob Babel. He's managed to sneak past security and slip into an exclusive year-end party.
This is Bob Babel, babbling on the street reporter here at the holiday party of the year. The room is crowded with people on the A-list and a few other lists as well. Standing next to me is Don Young. Congressman Young, what's the mantra you use to keep getting reelected?
Forever young.
Look at Senator Mark Begich. Senator, what was it like being the lone senator for Alaska in the weeks following the recent election?
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
And it's Senator John Kerry, one of the richest people in Congress. Senator, how do you feel about tax cuts for the wealthy?
Let's hang on to what we've got.
And speaking of Congress, it's Lisa Murkowski. Senator, how do you feel about your fellow Republicans giving you the cold shoulder this past couple of months?
It's my party and I'll cry if I want to.
And it's Larry Murkowski, one of 2,479 write-in candidates for senator. What's on your mind? Speaking of candidates, it's Joe Miller. Well, almost senator. How do you feel these days?
Somebody help me.
Could you clarify that, please?
I fought the law and the law won.
I see, and what's next on your schedule?
Pick myself up and get back in the race.
Well, look who's back in Alaska. It's former Governor Sarah Palin. Sarah, you've been at odds with the media lately. Could you please spell out exactly what you'd like from them?
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
What do you want them to do?
You better think about what you're trying to do to me.
Well, that's about it from Party Central here as we wrap up 2010. This is Bob Babel wishing you all a Happy New Year.
Bob Babel comes to us through the courtesy and imagination of Jeff Brown of KTOO in Juneau. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Rosemary Alexander and Jeff Brown in Juneau, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. From all of us here at APRN, I'm Lori Townsend wishing you a Happy New Year.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.